welcome to visitors, a special welcome to members, an extra special welcome to Dr. and Mrs. Andrew Malcolm, who are about halfway through their BC visit, as while Dr. Malcolm is Cecil and Ida Green visiting lecturer at the university. Dr. Malcolm is a graduate in medicine from the University of Toronto. He interned in the state of New York, and he had further studies in England. He is now a psychiatrist in private practice in Toronto. Before that, he was founder and first director of the Community Mental Health Clinic at the Ontario Hospital in Whitby, and he served in various capacities at the Addiction Research Foundation in Ontario. He has appeared as an expert witness in many trials in Ontario. He has received professional honors in Canada and the United States. He has published many scientific papers and 5 books, one of which is a novel. The only defect I've been able to discover in conversation with him is that while he and I were contemporaries at high school in Ottawa, he went to Ottawa's other high school. Dr. Malcolm's talk tonight is entitled The Use and Abuse of the Forensic Psychiatrist in Our Courts. I welcome Dr. Malcolm.
Thank you very much. Actually, when I was writing this talk that I'm going to give tonight, I had to do a certain amount of rooting about in the criminal code, and I came upon a most delightful piece of poetry in that work. It may be that you're not familiar with the fact that the Criminal Code of Canada is poetic, but I have a piece of found poetry. That's the kind of poetry that one lifts holus bolus from some work that is written without any poetic intent in the first instance. And in fact, I was so pleased with this bit when I came upon it that, in fact, I'm not really calling my talk what he said it's going to be at all. In fact, tonight I'm going to be talking about the following topic. Everyone shall, until the contrary is proved, be presumed to be and to have been sane. Now, our courts today are graced by a whole series of expert witnesses. As a matter of fact, the insinuation of these people into so many facets of our criminal justice system has come to be regarded by a fair number of us as a rather menacing benefit. There's a very intriguing range of experts, of course, but in the very peculiar environment of the courtroom, the very weakest of these are often confused with the strongest, and that's where a certain number of problems arise. I'd like to describe the spectrum rather briefly. They go from the hard end of the scale to the soft end of the scale. We have certain dispassionate scientists, for example, who sit about all day in laboratories, and they operate infrared spectroscopes and gas chromatographs, and they have a whole battery of microscopes, from the simple to the compound to the scanning electron. Now, these are terribly virtuous fellows, and they enter the courtroom with the understanding that the forensic scientist is a person not interested in the cause of the defense or of the Crown. And these people stand up in court, and they make all the softer experts cringe ever so slightly when they produce the following kind of line. The sample of blood examined in our laboratory was ABN Rh negative PGM2 AK2-1, and such a combination occurs in 12 people in 1 million, period. Now, the victim, we already have learned, was found under a bush about a mile from the apartment of the accused, and the blood stain examined by the experts was lifted from the apartment. The accused was type A. Think about that for a minute. And the victim was one of 12 people in a city of a million. Well, who among us would be so presumptuous as to doubt the legitimacy of so completely objective a report as the one that we've just heard? After all, the entire understanding of this deceased person has been learned by this man purely by looking through microscopes and fiddling about with test tubes. These people never see daylight, these forensic scientists. They're very pale and emaciated, but accurate. That's the thing. All right, now, a second expert is sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help him God, and he says, the gun was a Walters. Now, he then may say, well, he may add a little grace note here. He's not under any obligation to do so, and frequently he doesn't, but he might say, just to edify the court a little further, such a gun was commonly lifted from German officers in Holland in about 1944. It was greatly prized by Allied servicemen. They could buy it sometimes for a few packages of cigarettes. And then he'd get down to the real business and he'd say, we fired this gun. It was in firing condition. And we'd recovered a slug which bore lines on it that were remarkably similar to the slug that was given to us and that was said to have been recovered from the liver of the deceased. Well, now notice that he didn't even ever see the deceased. All he ever saw was this bullet, you see. Now, this is still pretty firm stuff, although I must say that the ballistics experts are the very first to say that their science is anything but exact. And fingerprinting analysts are similarly humble, and so are toxicologists. But there's no doubt that these people are regarded with a fair amount of awe in our courts because there is this curious accuracy that afflicts them all the time. And their wizardry is constantly confirmed. I mean, there was a case in Toronto shortly before I came out here, and it was a hit-and-run accident in which a woman was killed. And all they had was a little chip of blue paint, 1/64th of an inch in diameter. I mean, it's a very small piece of blue paint. They also had a piece of plastic that had come from an automobile, torn off some part of the inside of the thing. Now, the experts looked at this and they said, aha, it's General Motors. Oh, that's very nice. But there's still almost a million General Motors cars around. So that's not too helpful. But then they went out to Oshawa, and the people there said, oh, well, this is obviously a Chevelle. And then they looked at this piece of plastic further, and they said, now, in 1976, the particular machine that stamped out that piece of plastic made grooves on the housing of this instrument, and it didn't have anything to do with the operation of the car, but we can just tell you it did have these grooves. This was a 1976 Chevelle. And, of course, it was blue, because we had this piece of paint. Now, the police proceeded to look in parking garages very near to where this woman was killed, and one of the very first blue Chevelles they came upon, they lifted the hood, they stepped forward, and they fitted their piece exactly to the piece inside the car. Now, our progress has to be in the direction of the softer scientists now. We have the pathologists. These people will agree that the bullet was found in the liver, but they will not be in perfect agreement as to its course from the gun to that final resting place. The radiologists and the internists may also speak, but they know perfectly well that their findings will be disputed by other radiologists and internists who are equally distinguished. And in fact, we have to notice here that as soon as we introduce the medical specialists, we find ourselves in a kind of woolly world of opinion. And science, as a very hard and irrefutable discipline, begins to lose its definition ever so slightly. For example, these pathologists will say, now, based on the examination of the stomach contents, this person died 3 hours ago. But another pathologist will say, but on the other hand, based on an examination of the stomach contents, this person died 6 hours ago. And the problem here is that if the correct hour was naturally 6 hours, then there are witnesses who will testify that the accused was seen in the vicinity of the crime. But if the answer is 3 hours, then there are witnesses who are prepared to testify under oath that he was attending a very long and very tiresome performance of Das Rheingold. And therefore, the crime was either contained or it was not contained by the performance. And these two pathologists, mind you, are equally learned and equally beautiful, and so there is a problem here. Now, we have departed from science, but we have not flown away from it as far as we can go. And the psychiatric expert witness, with his retinue of psychologists and caseworkers, now steps forward with the intention of assisting the court. Now, the jury still remembers the amazing testimony of all these people who looked at paint and body secretions and dirt and fibers and blood and pieces of glass and vegetable matter and drugs. They still remember all this wizardry, and they say to themselves, maybe they say this, here we have another forensic scientist who will make similarly precise observations about personality type and about mental illness and about the guilty mind, you see. Now, here I can say with some emphasis that objectivity is crippled and kind of flies away from the courtroom a little bit, because we've arrived now at the soft end of the spectrum, in my opinion. I've myself been involved in about 40 murder trials, and so I know from personal experience that we're at that end of the spectrum. The forensic psychiatrist is being asked today to express his opinion with regard to a tremendous number of issues that are very crucial to our criminal justice system. His incursion has taken place because it's been decided that his field must have benefited from the general advance of science, which surrounds us and with which we know a great deal. And look, there has been much advance in psychiatry. The problem is that this progress has been very uneven, and as we'll see, it's the very questions that are most frequently of interest to the courts that cannot be well answered at this point in time. This is not by any means entirely referable to the primitive state of the art of psychiatry. There are certain peculiar imperatives that seem to guide our judicial ritual that really serve to diminish the value of psychiatric testimony, regardless of its serious and learned intent, almost to the point of absurdity at times. The psychiatrist in his office is a far more useful person than he can ever hope to be when he's being closely examined in a witness box according to rules of evidence that are to him extremely alien and quite limiting. Now, this conflict has increased in intensity for at least a century, I would say about a century and a half. It happens that both lawyers and psychiatrists are students of man and of his community. This common interest brings them together. But you see, the field on which their intercourse takes place is the private estate of the lawyers. And on this terrain, the psychiatrist is caused to feel that the hounds have a very distinct advantage over the fox. At least that's the impression that we have a tendency to feel when we get into the witness box there. Now, consider this issue of mens rea, or the guilty mind. The lawyers are interested in this matter because for about 1,000 years, guilt or innocence has depended on the answer to a very deceptively simple question. Did the accused know that his act was wrong? Now, you'll observe that this is a moral question, but a moral judgment, or any kind of judgment for that matter, is something that can be made only through the operation of the mind. And the mind is the domain of the psychiatrist. At least he has laid a claim to that field. Who then would be best qualified to express an opinion as to whether or not the accused suffered from such a disease of the mind as to be unable to distinguish between right and wrong? Now, before the time of Sigmund Freud, before, as a matter of fact, the time of Harold or William the Conqueror, I gather that disputes in England were settled by something called a blood feud. If you thought you were wronged, you just dealt with the fellow with whom you had a grievance. And in time, the idea of compensation developed, whereby the aggrieved party simply took some part of the possessions of his enemy. Even so, this amount paid was not enough. The secular arm might have been happy with this compensation, but the church was not. There must be penance to atone for the offense, and this penance must be based on the nature of the crime and the culpability of the accused. Now, in this principle, we can see the emergence of the idea that the guilty mind is an essential ingredient in the commission of a great variety of crimes. The common law, which seems to me to be an accumulation of decisions made by the people over an awfully long time, was joined by statute law as soon as the English state started gaining power in its own right. Certain crimes, such as murder and arson, treason and theft too, were felt to be so serious and so threatening to the state that they should no longer be dealt with according to common tradition, penance and compensation. The state, therefore, presumed to punish offenders with death, banishment, or forfeiture. And, of course, trial by ordeal eventually gave way to trial by jury. Now, it's to me the greatest interest to note that in the old system, both children and lunatics, as they put it, were exempted from punishment. That was always the case, apparently. Well, at least as far as I can figure out. Their relatives, however, were expected to satisfy the requirements of penance and compensation. Now, this Anglo-Saxon idea was incorporated into the statutes of England, but very often what happened was that the juries just dismissed the charges against the child or the madman without going to the trouble of actually having a trial. The Crown, for its part, was perfectly happy about this way of handling children. But apparently in the 13th century, it thought that to dismiss idiots and madmen was to infringe on the rights of the state, and this didn't seem like a good thing. And so then they said all accused people, other than children, were to be tried, but then on being found guilty and insane, the convicted person would be granted a pardon as rule. This was known as the King's Mercy. There were still no psychiatrists on the scene way back in the 13th century. Now, in the 14th century, the idea that madness should be regarded as a defense to some criminal charge reappeared. And from the time of Edward III, not every lunatic was found guilty and then automatically pardoned. Some of them were found not guilty by reason of insanity. And the problem became gradually clearer as these centuries went along. There were no tests, you see, that might be used to determine the presence of insanity. And there was a great deal of inconsistency, obviously. Nothing was standardized. In the 17th century, a man named Sir Edward Coke thought he'd like to address himself to this problem, and he tried to outline a few rules. He said there were four kinds of madness that might interest the legal system. He said a person might be an idiot. That was the first thing. Then he said, well, he might be through sickness or grief, a person who had lost his memory or understanding. That's a little on the vague side, but anyway. Or he might be a person who might sometime have had understanding and sometime not. He also said that. And then he said, finally, a person might have become voluntarily drunk. Now, Sir Edward said only the first three of these should qualify as legitimate defenses. That's very interesting to me, because in our time, the defense of intoxication has made great progress and has often been advanced, and very often it has been successful. Sir Edward would have thrown out intoxication if it was voluntary. it's quite clear in our time too that if the man was involuntarily intoxicated, that would be a defense. Now, toward the end of the 17th century, I found a very nice bit. A judge ruled that for the insanity defense to be valid, the accused would have to be totally deprived of his understanding and memory, so as not to know what he was doing, no more than an infant, a brute, or a wild beast. Now, it's reassuring to know that there were no psychiatrists around at that time who might have made a determination as to the thought inside the head of a wild beast. Presumably, the judge and the jury were considered competent enough to make this kind of determination. That's an interesting thing to think about, I think. Then in 1800, there was a very important trial. A man named James Hadfield recognized that he was the savior of mankind. And being the savior, it would be necessary for him to be executed. Now, Hadfield, in order to atone for the sins of all men, Hadfield hit upon a very indirect way of bringing about his own execution. He decided that he would assassinate George III during a theatrical performance. And then, Hadfield reasoned, he would be captured and then executed, and then all men would be saved from doom. Now, as it happens, Hadfield had a red-hot lawyer, and this lawyer convinced the jury that his client was suffering from an insane delusion, and poor old Hadfield was acquitted, much to the chagrin of Hadfield and the king. Now, at this point, psychiatry was clearly stirring in the bushes, I can assure you. The early history of that discipline was beginning to kind of get moving a little bit. And the attempt to define, describe, and classify various states of unreason had already begun. In fact, in 1843, a very peculiar breed of physician had definitely emerged. These physicians interested themselves in problems relating to the mind. This was the year that the famous Daniel McNaughton shot the private secretary of Sir Robert Peel, the Prime Minister of England. Now, Daniel McNaughton actually intended to shoot Sir Robert himself, but he actually made a mistake and shot the private secretary. He was charged with murder, and he was brought to trial. And it's very interesting that nine learned physicians stepped forward and convinced the jury that McNaughton was insane, and he was acquitted. And this was the result of this trial was very upsetting to every person who regarded himself as the possible target for an assassin. And Queen Victoria was extremely upset about this matter. And so she caused 15 judges of the common law courts to gather together, and they were to answer five questions that would be put to them by the House of Lords. Now, the answers to these five questions became the basis of what was called the McNaughton Rules. These rules were very quickly accepted in virtually every jurisdiction in the English-speaking world, England and Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and in virtually every state of the Union. Actually, as far as I know, every state of the Union, but anyway, I'll come back to New Hampshire in a few minutes. That's a special case in point, but it was after McNaughton that New Hampshire changed its rule. In Canada, the McNaughton rules are enshrined to this day in a rather synopsized form in Section 16 of our Criminal Code. Now, Section 16 states, 1, no person shall be convicted of an offense in respect of an act or omission on his part while he was insane. Well, that seems reasonably straightforward. We have no problem with that. 2, for the purposes of this section, a person is insane when he is in a state of natural imbecility. You have to recognize that lawyers and psychiatrists do not speak the same language. They haven't spoken the same language for at least 100 years. Ever since the psychiatrists developed their own special jargon, we don't talk about natural imbecility, but lawyers like that expression. And this is their code right here. Or has disease of the mind to an extent that renders him incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of an act or omission, or of knowing that an act or omission is wrong. That's a very important statement. A person who has specific delusions but is in other respects sane shall not be acquitted on the ground of insanity unless the delusions caused him to believe in the existence of a state of things that, if it existed, would have justified or excused his act or omission. 4. Everyone shall, until the contrary is proved, be presumed to be and to have been sane. Now, it's of immense significance that according to this law, insanity is something that must be proved by the defense. You all recognize that guilt must be proved by the Crown, but if insanity is offered, it is up to the defense to prove it. The Crown has no immediate interest in that matter. It's the defense that has to establish it. And I have no doubt that it's reassuring for all of us to know that we're all regarded as sane by our country. I myself take great comfort in this agreeable thought. As a matter of fact, the only difficulty I have with this is that should I appear as the defendant in one of our courts, I'd have to endure the testimony of the psychiatrists for the defense to the effect that I was entirely out of my mind. Now, this exercise might be to my advantage, but as we shall see, it could just as easily not be to my advantage at all. It might even be a grievous assault on my civil rights. Now, as the Macnaghten rules were applied in the years following 1843, the lawyers showed a decided tendency to call for help every time a case where it seemed relevant came up. If their client was to suffer from a disease of the mind, such that he would be unable to know that an act or omission was wrong, then they, the lawyers, would rather like to be guided in making this determination by people who claimed expertise in the field. Macnaghten and psychiatry have grown up together over the last 135 years, but this association has not always been a happy one. Macnaghten has been described as being too rigid, too insistent upon an unambiguous answer to a most vague question. You see, lawyers are very peculiar people. They think that psychiatrists are peculiar. It may be that both groups are, if we would really look into the matter. Lawyers seem to view man in a kind of imaginary sort of way, sometimes almost a delusional way. The accused is either sane or insane. Now, everybody knows that that's ridiculous. He cannot either be sane or insane. Psychiatrists have learned through much training and experience that there are 1,000 gradations between sane and insane. But in our courts, these gradations are not particularly honored. And we also know that a given man may, at various times in his life, range from in one direction or the other, being occasionally more rational and then as often less so. Nothing is exact. There is no such thing as the perfect man, and there's no such thing as the perfect anything, actually. But even so, this is the way we have to deal with this problem in our courts. Because, you see, insanity is a question of fact. That the word fact is a legal term. And insanity is something that must be established in the course of the trial, like all other kinds of facts. If the crime is that the accused is alleged to have stolen a candy bar, then it's very unlikely that the defense is going to argue insanity. Now, why is this so? Why wouldn't you argue insanity if that's all he did? Well, I'll tell you why. Because the penalty, should the accused be found insane, would be that he would be kept in strict custody until the pleasure of the lieutenant governor of the province is known. In such a case, it would be better to take one's chances without reference to section 16, if you see what I mean. The cases in which insanity are claimed are those in which the ordinary penalties provided by the criminal code are, as a rule, very severe. Homicide is perhaps the best example. In such cases, the pattern that has evolved is for the defense lawyer to be highly reluctant to depend on his own unsupported assertion to the effect that the man is insane. He'll then ask a psychiatrist, particularly one well known to him, to examine his client and report his findings. Now, the attorney in this ritual becomes the employer of the psychiatrist, and the latter is a loyal employee sometimes, and he may be rather strongly inclined to please the person who has retained him in the first instance and is going to be compensating him for his labors. In our system, there is something a bit unfair at this point in the situation. A defense lawyer can go to a psychiatrist and he can get a report. A mental state examination will be done. This has happened to me more than once. I've been asked to see a man who's committed a murder, and I've written a report that did not please the lawyer. And the lawyer then said to me, "Well, look, thank you very much, doctor. It's very kind of you to have gone to the jail and to have seen my client. But I'll tell you, I'm going to go and ask Dr. X if he would like to see him. And by the way, I won't be calling you when the trial comes up." Now, this defense lawyer will not give my report to the Crown. But if the Crown calls me, and I say to the Crown, and the Crown is not interested in insanity, you recognize, if I say, but this man is a very disturbed person, he's a very, very sick man, the Crown will give my letter to the defense, in which case it's happened quite often that I've been called by the defense to testify, even though I actually was asked to see the man by the Crown. The letters go in that direction, but they do not go in the other direction, which I think is really not quite fair. Sometimes they do, but they don't seem to have to. That's the point. I've known defense people who have given the Crown letters. It has happened lots of times. So what happens is that the Crown goes shopping until he finds the right psychiatrist. Now, there are lots of easy cases. I'll just give you one small example of such a case. It isn't really 10 minutes to 9, is it?
Not quite.
All right. Well, I mean, here's an example, very briefly. I had to see a man a few years ago who reached the conclusion that the Kodiak bear at the Toronto Zoo was a conspirator set upon the destruction of the world. This bear spoke only in Albanian. Now, this man actually bought himself a gun and went to the zoo and shot the bear dead and walked a certain distance away and was arrested. He gave himself up in a very exultant state because he had saved the world from certain doom. He was taken down to the Queen Street Mental Health Center, and indeed, I think just about everybody would have agreed that he was a paranoid schizophrenic with very florid delusions. I think that there would almost have been perfect agreement in any court of law that he was insane. He wasn't charged with murder because he killed a bear, but he could have killed a person just as easily. After all, it's the same kind of thing. From his point of view, it was just delusional. The cases where the difficulty arises are not cases like that. It's when the man doesn't seem particularly insane, where the 12 members of the jury would think of this fellow as really being not terribly unlike themselves, perhaps, not terribly disturbed at all. Yet, they are also cases where there's absolutely no doubt who pulled the trigger. I mean, there are witnesses. He killed somebody in front of three policemen or whatever. Everybody knows who committed the murder or who did the act of killing somebody, and there's no defense left except Section 16. In those cases, especially if the man seems perfectly sort of reasonable, then the thing becomes terribly complicated. And that's when the insanity defense is offered, and what happens, you see, is that the defense will lay on a psychiatrist, the Crown will discover that this has happened, and they in turn will retain the services of two even more distinguished psychiatrists. And the defense, on learning that these two great men have been laid on by the Crown, will go to some length to retain even more learned doctors, perhaps reaching as far away as a distant city to fly them in from someplace else. Even more learned people with even more papers written and books published and appearances registered, so that the jury will be convinced beyond any doubt that the man is one thing or the other, depending on which side the lawyer wants to establish. Actually, you see, I'm not really making this up as a kind of absurd fantasy. There was a case in Toronto just about a year ago where a man tortured and then murdered his wife, and the Crown produced three psychiatrists, all of whom testified to the effect that the accused was perfectly sane. The defense countered with four psychiatrists, all of whom testified to the effect that the man was perfectly insane. The Crown, on learning about that, retained two more psychiatrists, both of whom asserted that the man was quite sane when he killed his wife. Now, the expert witnesses in this case, when they were all added together, came to nine and could have formed a jury with three members sick. Now, they would have been a hung jury because there was no way that they could agree. But really, what is the real jury to think in a situation like that? I mean, that really is absurd. The judge has already instructed them that they alone must come to a decision of guilt or innocence on the basis of all the facts. But now the facts are so thoroughly confused that nobody has the slightest idea what happened. And all of these people are awfully decent and learned and everything like that. So the jury must imagine that the judicial system has gone a little mad. And now, psychiatrists, in my opinion, generally make rather poor adversaries. They really aren't awfully comfortable in that role, and sometimes I even wonder how come they get trapped in this adversarial situation. This is really the lawyer's game in our society, and I don't doubt that this dramatic courtroom confrontation is a very healthy part of our culture. The accused has to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and he must also be just as vigorously defended. The judge will be present to ensure that the rules of evidence aren't violated and that a proper decorum is maintained throughout the trial. He has all kinds of functions, but he sees that the accused is treated fairly, and he instructs the jury as to the niceties of the law. I mean, he does all kinds of things. What about the psychiatrist? What's he doing there anyway? Well, it's a rather strange culture for him to be in. He's a human being. He's not an automaton. He's not a mental invalid. He has many attitudes and sentiments and values that he knows about. He's a person who has a moral system of some kind. He's bound to see some people whose behavior he personally disapproves of. But his responsibility is to do a mental status examination, that's all, to find out if this man is suffering from some disorder of the mind. That's what he has studied, and that's what he should be in there to do. In my opinion, the psychiatrist should never try to please any lawyer. He should carefully just do the thing he's supposed to do, which is to do a mental status examination, and never be even slightly concerned what the lawyer would like him to report. If he should be thrown out by his employer, then fine, just accept the decision and know that his conscience is clear. Also, the psychiatrist should make it quite clear to everybody involved that his is not an exact science. And when he's on the stand, he should resist any attempt on the part of lawyers to establish that the contrary is true. The psychiatrist does not speak ex cathedra when he's on the stand. And actually, I find it a little bit unsettling when some of my colleagues give the impression that they really are the repositories of the answers to all the imponderable questions. I wish that my colleagues would be more comfortable about saying I don't know a little more often without being afraid. Perhaps they feel that if they say they don't know, this admission of ignorance is going to discredit them. And after all, they're one half of the lawyers in the courtroom are trying to discredit them. So they're in a rather difficult situation. And some of them are unnerved. They are vulnerable. But that is their situation. And I think it's a bit unbecoming of some of them to sort of prop themselves up by pretending to know more than they do know. See, the lawyers are going to trap them every time they get a chance. You know what the lawyers will do? Psychiatrists know that everything is gray. It's a range of things. But these lawyers are going to step up and they're going to say, now, in a word, doctor, exactly what is schizophrenia? Now, you see, they will. I mean, this has happened to me. The lawyer is liable to say, if the accused man had a blood alcohol count of 1.5 milligrams per cent at the time of the shooting, what was his mental state? Now, look, there are many variables that will determine this fellow's mental state. Or else, one that was recently put to me, is the psychopathic personality a disease of the mind? Now, that's a particularly cunning trap, because disease of the mind sounds like a medical term, doesn't it? But in fact, it's a legal term. The lawyer has it in his mind that disease of the mind occurs in Section 16, you see. But a lot of these doctors who appear in court have never read Section 16, and they don't know that that cute little question is one very heavy trap. Is the psychopathic personality a disease of the mind? Well, any psychiatrist is going to say, well, sure. I mean, look, it all comes from the mind, doesn't it? This man is thinking and acting and feeling in a very unusual way. We would regard him as being pathological. The lawyer says, terrific, fine, disease of the mind, Section 16. But in fact, actually, he knew perfectly well what he was doing when he pulled the trigger. And so within the real meaning of the legal definition of insanity, he knew what he was doing. And so that's, the Crown is put on a difficult position immediately that happens. And it seems to me that if the courts don't think that the psychiatrists are helpful because they refuse to be precise when they're speaking about matters about which precision is perfectly impossible, then I would say just let the courts get on without this expert assistance, because I think they're perfectly capable of doing it. They have 12 members of the jury and they have a judge, and for an awfully long time they did pretty well in reaching a pretty good justice. But anyway, I don't feel that psychiatrists should do too much apologizing for the insufficiency of their understanding of the mind. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you all a secret. I hope we never find out all about the mind, because if we all become perfectly transparent, it will not thereby become a better place for us all to live in. We are not looking, I would hope, for astounding scientific breakthroughs that will make us all perfectly understandable. Let's hope that psychiatry continues to labor behind the nuclear physicists for a good time to come yet. Now, I remember all kinds of other funny things can happen. I remember testifying at the trial of four men who were accused of raping and murdering a young boy above a young street body rub parlor. He was a shoeshine boy. And I saw all four of these men, And I knew that I'd be asked to testify, and I was quite prepared to do that, and I appeared at that trial. Now, the first defense man stepped forward, and he said, now tell me, doctor, this is really just a whole bunch of fortune-telling, isn't it? It's really just crystal ball gazing that you're into here, isn't it? Now, you see, that's fine. It was an interesting question. I liked the question. I liked it to myself. But being on the stand, I mean, one isn't about to say, you're absolutely right. It's nothing but fortune-telling. Because, you see, it isn't precisely fortune-telling. We've really gone way beyond that. We really can carry out a mental status examination, and we can make some pretty informed statements with respect to the existence or absence of, say, the psychopathic personality, which the people in this case tended to have. So I could have said these things. all I can tell you here is that this did set a rather adversarial tone to the proceedings, because I was rendered ever so slightly defensive by this charge. It means I don't see myself as a crystal ball gazer, exactly. On the contrary, and yet I also realize that I don't know everything about the mentation of these people that I talk to. Anyway, lawyers will do this kind of thing. Lawyers, you see, seem to enjoy these postures of defense and attack. It's characteristic of their behavior in the courtroom. And on examining a witness, the lawyers can do something else that's pretty cute, too. They can pretend utter ignorance of some subject. They're just there to ask the questions. They don't know anything about this thing. Now look, they've been up every night reading all the textbooks. They know all kinds of stuff. I know this perfectly well because I've had lunch with them, and some of them are even my friends. And I know that they're not so naive. But in the court, they pretend that they just don't know anything. And can you please help me here, you know, to tell me what does this mean, you see? And very often their questions are very cunning. You see, only the witness risks humiliation. The lawyer doesn't. He's fine. He doesn't know anything. He didn't ever claim he knew anything. But why is this witness there? He's there because he claims he knows all about psychiatry. So what do you mean? Don't you know the answer to this one? And so this lawyer has a kind of license to know nothing at all. It's really wonderful. He asks all the questions, and he maintains complete control over this extremely unnatural conversation that ensues. In our courtrooms, the whole raison d'etre of the psychiatrist is either ignored or fractured. Sometimes it's honored, but not always. This poor psychiatrist either knows, or he'll soon learn, that he will not be permitted to speak for very long without being interrupted and steered in some entirely new direction. It's not like talking to a patient or some friend or anybody else. It's a very weird conversation that goes on when one is being cross-examined or examined in a witness box. The psychiatrist, if he has some experience, also knows that the questions will be full of little traps, and that actually no one, with the possible exception of the judge, will really be interested in what he really thinks about this thing, as long if what he thinks is not supportive of the position of whomever is asking the questions. He knows that the lawyers are going to make every effort to establish that he is one of two things: an august expert, the most of this type in the whole world, or a shameful fraud who has no business being there at all. He knows that every effort on his part to qualify his opinion will be sneered at by everybody, and that this tendency to just abhor black and white in favor of gray is felt as somehow disreputable. He should be precise. He should say, that is the answer to this thing. Or on the other hand, that is his point. He also knows, by the way, after he's been in a certain number of trials, that nobody in the court is really interested in his innate decency or even in his genuine interest in the human condition or his inclination to be sympathetic or even the broad knowledge that he has of his field. The only thing that's important in this very alien environment is whether he thinks the accused man was non compos mentis at the time he is alleged to have committed the crime. And considering these circumstances, I regret to say sometimes it has happened that some of my colleagues have a tendency to become a little nervous, I guess. Maybe that's the explanation, if I'm to be most charitable about this. And they sometimes will say things that will please their employer. I regret that very much indeed. I think that psychiatrists should never care at all what the lawyers think. Most of my colleagues, I'm happy to say, behave quite differently. They've recognized the difficulty of speaking intelligently when they're restrained by the very strange rules of discourse that have come to prevail in our courts. But they've decided that they're going to make every effort to just offer their best opinion, whether this is agreeable or not. Now, psychiatrists are asked to do quite a number of things. I want to mention a few of them, but I'll have to go a little faster here because things are going along too fast, aren't they? They're asked to do quite a few things in our courts, and some of them are very pleasurable. Very briefly, they can give information. I had a lovely experience like this. I was four men were accused of committing the first contract murder that was ever carried out in Prince Edward Island. And they were found guilty of this murder. But they claimed that they were very intoxicated when they did the murder. I was sent down to Charlottetown simply to give information to the court as to the effects of drugs. They had already been found guilty of this crime. It was amazing how comfortable the whole thing was. It wasn't the least bit adversarial. It was just most agreeable, and I was allowed to talk on and on and on and say all kinds of things and qualify everything under the sun, and it was just a delight. But anyway, as a rule, one must realize that one is not much more than an instrument to be either wielded or blunted by the adversaries as justice in mysterious ways seems to get done. Now, psychiatrists can also be asked to give opinions as to the fitness of the accused to stand trial, may be asked to comment on the credibility of witnesses. That's a very interesting and difficult problem. I want to talk about that in a minute. He may be examined on such issues as insanity, and then a really bad one, dangerousness, that comes up. I want to talk about that too. The effects of intoxication, another one, common. Mental consequences of provocation, they can be asked that. And also the possibility that a particular person might either be cured by treatment or deterred by punishment. Such questions also can arise. Now, some of these involvements are very easy and comfortable. Some of them are very uncomfortable. Fitness to stand trial is a difficult case in point. I've got a case that I'm very familiar with right now that I think is a real problem. The man in this case who committed a murder was actually brought to trial. And then the defense, I was asked to see him by the Crown. Now, the defense argued desperately that he was not fit. Now, the difficulty here was that the man was extremely stupid. He was feeble-minded, as it used to be said a few years ago. He worked all day long beside one of the lesser Great Lakes, but he couldn't name a single Great Lake, for example. He was a very unintelligent fellow. But now, you see, the judge decided to discontinue the trial because the defense produced so many distinguished psychiatrists who were just burdened with such vast degrees and accomplishments that the judge was put on a very difficult spot. And I guess he decided, well, look, if you people really think he's not fit, I guess I better send him to Penetang, which is the hospital for the criminally insane in Ontario. And this man was not found guilty or innocent. He was also not found insane. He was found not fit. And he's now up at Penetang, where the doctors are not magicians, where they are not able to make him bright. But he was not fit because he was stupid, you see. How will he ever be fit? He could be at Penetang for life, and he might be innocent. You see how that's a trap, a very dangerous trap. And I don't know what the result's going to be, but I find that a disturbing thing. I thought he was fit. To be fit, I mean, I talked to a lot of lawyers about this and to some judges to try to find out what they meant. Well, what is it to be fit? Well, you have to understand the rules of procedure. You know what the judge does and what the Crown does and what the defense does, what the lawyer, what the jury is all about, and so on. And this fellow was fit. He knew, he could tell me what all these people were supposed to do. And he also told me that the what his lawyer was supposed to do for him. He said, I asked him, well, what's your lawyer supposed to do? And he said, well, my lawyer is supposed to be in the court to get the charge reduced to manslaughter since I was drunk when I killed her. Well, that's pretty smart, you see. Indeed, he'd learned that that's what it was all about. So he was fit. He could follow the thing well enough. It would have been better for him. He may have been drunk enough. Maybe that's how it could have been found in the end, you see. The defense might have had good evidence to show that he was sufficiently drunk that they could have gotten away with that defense. But until he comes back to court, I guess that will not be proven. Now, the problem of dangerousness, I'm very troubled about that. It's a very delicate and disturbing situation. I was very recently given a commission by the province of Ontario, by the Attorney General, to see a man who had been convicted of rape. And they wanted to apply what was called the Dangerous Sexual Offender Act, Section 688 of the Criminal Code. This is applied occasionally in the cases of people who have a very long and very bad history of dangerous behavior. The province, the Attorney General, can decide through his agents that this man should be sentenced according to the information in Section 688. Now, this is a very dangerous piece of law, it seems to me, and no lawyer has ever been able to convince me differently, because the man was already found guilty of rape, and the law does provide for a very severe penalty for a man who's so found. But you see, this act, or this section, reads that the offender has shown a failure to control his sexual impulses, and there is a likelihood of his causing injury, pain, or other evil to other persons through failure in the future. Think about that. The man is going to be given an indeterminate sentence for a crime that he has not committed. And I don't think any judge or any psychiatrist should be asked to guess as to the future. I think that it's good enough that he committed a rape and he should be severely dealt with according to what's available according to such a crime. I don't like Section 688 personally, and I'm not going to do another one, quite frankly. I got involved in this one, and indeed I thought the man was terribly dangerous. But I didn't know anything more than the judge did. All I had was all of the incredible record that this guy had, and the many incarcerations, all for rape and assorted assaults and everything else. Of course he's dangerous, but he didn't have to be found, or he didn't have to be sentenced under that thing. I think it's a convulsive reaction to an underuse of the provisions that are already available to the courts in the case of initial rape, quite frankly. That's my opinion. You see, dangerousness is not something that can be easily diagnosed with any degree of certainty. There are no guidelines. There are no adequate tests, no objective measurements. You can't be positive. You can get an impression that you think, well, it's based really on what he's done in the past. But you could be wrong, and it would be better not to punish people for crimes they have not committed. The credibility of a witness, that's a nasty business, and I was involved in one of those, too. A few years ago, a very prominent defense man asked me to see somebody. He wanted me to get into the witness box and comment on the personality of the Crown's principal witness. This woman is the only one who saw the accused just outside the place where the man was shot, and he was there at the right time and everything else. And it happens that she had a grudge against this man too, and she was an outrageous psychopathic personality. She was a very unreliable woman in every respect. But you know something? As soon as the judge found out that the defense was going to put me on the stand and that I might make certain observations about the personality of this witness, the judge threw me out of the court right onto my head, and I was delighted. I was overjoyed to get thrown out, because I think he should have thrown me out. You see what could happen? If things like that were allowed to go through, well then, here we have the expert witnesses being brought in by the defense and by the Crown to claim that every single witness is not credible or is disturbed in some way. And that's really a bad business. I think if any lawyer can't on his own hook demonstrate the unreliability and bias of some witness, then he shouldn't be representing that client in the first instance. This was a very vengeful and hostile woman, and I shouldn't have been involved in that case. I was absolutely delighted to get thrown out of the courtroom, and I'm not going to accept any more funny tricks like that. Now, insanity, that's, of course, the very field of competence that psychiatrists are supposed to know most about. I mean, they've read all the books, in fact, and they've seen all the patients more than anybody else, and they have some intelligence, and they should be able to make some observations there. Now, the thing is that they are better than anybody else in the courtroom at this particular subject, but they're not so much better to justify the triumphant advance that has characterized them in recent years. And that, to me, is a very big problem. And I haven't got the answer to that. I've offered a number of answers in the past. It's true that the psychiatrist can form an opinion, but no one will be certain about whether he's an honest man because another psychiatrist is going to contradict this opinion in a few minutes anyway. Now, this could mean that psychiatry is terribly inexact, or one of them could be a liar, or whatever. It could be anything, almost. I might mention briefly that we, of course, operate under the McNaughton rules, but New Hampshire threw that out in 1869, and they said it should be only a disease of the mind. That was forgotten for 100 years. And then in 1954, in Durham versus the United States, Judge Bazelon of the United States District Court of Appeals enunciated a virtually identical rule as the one set forth in New Hampshire, that it should be only disease of the mind that we should be concerned about. It shouldn't be moral knowledge on the grounds that that wasn't scientific and we're all scientists now and therefore we shouldn't make moral judgments. It should be strictly disease of the mind. There was a great deal of joy in both psychiatric and legal circles from coast to coast when Durham went through and a few other related decisions. This joy derived from the belief that the concept of mental illness was an awful lot more appropriate, modern, and scientific than was the old McNaughton test of moral knowledge. In Canada, we're still guided by McNaughton, but don't you worry, Durham has affected us very, very much anyway, in little ways. There were great expectations around this time because it was thought that Durham was very enlightened. It permitted the rational use of modern psychiatric science. Actually, all it's really done is to sanction the unwarranted further intrusion into the courts of all kinds of new experts. And you know what's wrong with that, in my opinion? I mean, I don't mind experts. I think they're kind of nice. Often they're fairly decent fellows. The problem with them is that they usurp the function of the jury. This is what I find disturbing about these people. You see, the jury system is obviously absurd and irrational. If you think about it, it's silly. There are 12 people chosen in the most illogical way. You should sit in a courtroom sometime and see how juries are chosen. It's really a wonderland to see this thing done, you know, stand down and all this stuff. It's amazing how they choose juries. Now, they're chosen by the adversaries, and then these 12 people are asked to listen to all the evidence, and then the judges charge. Then they're supposed to retire until they reach a verdict. And it's obviously preposterous and it's archaic, and in my opinion, it's an invention of soaring genius. And this is because it's because of our juries, it seems to me, that justice is not only done but seen to be done. And yet there are very powerful trends today that are based on the conviction that the world is much too complex and technical for the jury to truly understand. The experts have been permitted to confound the jury, and they've diminished its traditional prominence in our courts of law. Now, this is my opinion. I think that the time has come for our judges to reaffirm the supremacy of the jury. in our system of law. I don't think it's too late to check the advance of these experts who abrogated so much of the authority of this ancient institution. You see, in my opinion, it's the jury and not the forensic experts which represents the strongest defense against the threat of human engineering and of all such enlightened ideas that would be arbitrarily imposed in the best interests of the presumably benighted people. Now, in a society that is progressively becoming more technocratic and at the same time more receptive to the growth in size and power of various governments, there's a very great danger that the ideas of the planners and the very highly educated people will prevail. And the planners, it need hardly be said, always know what is best for the people. And the planners are people who have studied a great deal. They're very wise fellows. Little by little, such old and irrational institutions as the jury system and the democratically elected parliaments will be discarded in favor of much more logical programs designed by the experts and bureaucrats. There's a real possible problem if you project our present trends on into the future. So what is this projection? Well, I think I can give you some impression of what the future is from my point of view. It's the Serbsky Institute of Forensic Psychiatry in Moscow. That's the future if we keep going too far in our present direction. To this very well-planned place, Serbsky, people who are afflicted with individualism and reformist zeal are sent so that their antisocial and deviant personalities can be treated. This institute is staffed by learned experts in forensic psychiatry. They also have read all the books and they've seen all the patients, just like we have. The only difference between them and our own group of forensic psychiatrists is that at Serbsky there is unanimity on the question of what constitutes madness. It's every condition that we recognize as such and dissidents too. You see, we don't recognize that as madness. It's, and this is a great problem. We've resisted using our psychiatrists as instruments of state and ideological control for a long time, but there's always the possibility that we could move in that direction. We must never permit ourselves to become complacent about this matter. It's not without some interest to me that it's the decided tendency of the majority of our own doctors, psychiatrists, to regard the perpetrators of major crimes, such as murder and assault, as suffering from mental illness. They tend to look upon these people that way. They're inclined to feel that people show signs of illness when they commit these kinds of crimes. Now, it would be through this sort of insidious development that the progressively broader spectrum of behavior could come to be regarded as evidence of psychiatric disability. We must be vigilant about that trend, that's all. We're far from it right now. I'm not issuing a complaint against our society now. I'm just warning us that we better be careful because we could go in that direction. In the very end, there would be very few criminals, but there would be an enormous number of clinically ill people requiring treatment for a very wide range of aberrant behavior. The facilitation of this process is another of the hazards, in my opinion, of inviting the experts in. See, the juries, this is the point I was trying to make a few minutes ago, they would be far less liable to redefine murder as an unfortunate expression of mental aberration. Juries really don't tend to look at it that way. The learned experts do tend to look at it that way. Now, we must also oppose every proposal that would encourage psychiatrists to become interrogators. That's vital. To get confessions from accused people. I recall being asked by a lawyer for the defense one time if what I was about to say was inculpatory or exculpatory. And I hesitated for the moment, and the lawyer thought I was merely stupid. And I wasn't. I actually knew. He said, "Do you know what these terms mean?" And I said, yep, I do. I know perfectly well. You know what my problem was, eh? It was that this fellow had told me in the most incredible detail that he had committed every aspect of the crime with which he had been charged. And he had given me information that was highly prejudicial to his case. The lawyer knew that if I was asked to say a sufficient number of things in a cunning enough way, I would say inculpatory things about his client. It was a very good question, and a very important question. It should be asked every single time, in my opinion. And now, this illustrates a very serious problem in the field of forensic psychiatry. People in general, you see, have come to believe that it's quite desirable and safe to talk to psychiatrists, and they do so with astonishing ease. It's amazing how they will talk, even when they're in a jail, I can assure you. I've noticed that people will reveal the most intimate details of their lives at the moment the discussion starts. Psychiatrists must never function as agents of the police. They are doing that in some countries, and that's a fearful thing, in my opinion. You see, they are in a peculiar position. They could easily operate as agents of the police. People really do talk to psychiatrists. It's astonishing. They must only do what they're retained to do, and that's to do a mental status examination. Now, that's why I'd like to mention this. I invariably begin every interview now with an accused person, and I think every psychiatrist should do that, in my opinion, by giving him certain essential pieces of information. I tell him that I'm a psychiatrist and that I've been asked to see him by Mr. X, the lawyer for the defense or the Crown, whichever the case may be. I then tell him that I may be asked to testify at his trial and that he is under absolutely no obligation whatsoever to say one single word to me if he doesn't feel like doing it. Now, the most amazing thing then happens. In every single case, they start talking to me, even though I've told them, well, look, you don't have to talk. I really go out of my way at this point to say, you don't have to say a word, but they still talk anyway. And incidentally, I never see an accused person for the Crown unless I've established that a lawyer has been retained for this man and that he's had a chance to talk to that lawyer. A number of years ago, I did see a man who was charged one of the earlier cases I've involved in. I saw a man before he had a lawyer, and so help me, the thing went to the Supreme Court of Canada in the end. It was really awful. I can assure you, ever since then, actually long before it went as far as the Supreme Court, I always refuse to see a man unless he's had a lawyer. But people will talk anyway, really quite urgently. Now, we have in this country a principle known as due process of law. This is maintained by a judiciary that's scrupulously independent, body of statutory law that's subject to amendment by an elected parliament, and an archaic but priceless institution known as the jury system. Now, any social trend that threatens the rule of law has got to be checked, because to fail to do this would enhance the power of those of us who would prefer the simplicity of an authoritarian state. Now, lawyers can be bought. We know they can be bought, and we accept this. In fact, it's one of our considerable strengths that lawyers can be bought. Psychiatrists can be bought. We know this, but we mustn't accept it because our acceptance of it is potentially very dangerous to us as free citizens. Judges cannot be bought, and whenever it's discovered that such a thing has happened, there's a great surge of outrage and the errant judge is dealt with. And finally, jurors can't be bought. Now, this is theoretically possible, but it's very rare and very hazardous. Yet, you know, today it's this vital jury system that the planners have decided is too cumbersome, too expensive, too irrational to be maintained. That our courts must be streamlined. They must become more Justinian. The experts must take the place of the 12 good men and true, because we live, after all, in the 20th century. This is the age of science. But the experts might conceivably be bought. Now, I can't possibly agree with those of us who feel that this trend is enlightened, even though it may seem logical and modern. And I fully realize that it would be unwise in any case to banish the experts from our courts. I think they do have a function. The more I really do recognize that they have a function. It's just that I would like to contain them, check them, make life difficult for them all the time, restrict what they can say. Of course it's an unnatural conversation, but I've decided in the end that's a very good thing. Now, a lot of American states allow the court to appoint psychiatrists. I've made that kind of suggestion in the past. But you know, that's no good because the parties can still retain their own lawyers, and what you get then is a great queue of lawyers going out of the courtroom and down a queue of psychiatrists. That doesn't work. The attempt has been made to protect psychiatrists against the adversarial conflict. But if the court starts appointing lawyers, then you could move in the direction of the Russian model. We have an interesting and difficult problem in Ontario right now. We've established a thing called the Metropolitan Toronto Forensic Service, METFOR as it's called. It's a thing established by the Ontario government. People can be taken there by the courts to have mental status examinations done. That could be a bad thing. And I'm sort of looking at that METFOR thing very carefully because I'm not so sure that psychiatrists should be public employees that way. I think it might be a dangerous thing. They might start in the end doing what the government wants. And I don't think that lawyers should ever do what the government wants when it comes to this matter of guilt or innocence. And I don't think that psychiatrists should be interested in what the lawyers for either side wants. I think it may be a good thing to have private psychiatrists around and be retained by the parties. Another suggestion, and I'll just keep you for another couple of minutes here. Another suggestion is to the effect that the intervention of the psychiatrist might be delayed until sentencing. That could be dangerous too. I have made that suggestion myself in a paper that I wrote a year or so ago. That's probably a bad idea. Do you know why? Because it means that mens rea is actually not dealt with in the way it should. It's been suggested that all people should be found guilty or not guilty, and then if they're not guilty, just acquitted, and if they're guilty, well then bring in the psychiatrists and find out whether they're sane or insane and send them to the penitentiary or the hospital, depending on what they say. But you see, by then, the whole matter of the guilty mind has been gone through in the body of the trial. And that doesn't seem to work. The psychiatrist will have something to say about that mental ingredient in the body of the trial. So I don't think that's a good idea either. I think it could even be dangerous. Now, sanity, you see, from a societal and also legal point of view, implies the existence of moral knowledge. Really, it is the jury that makes that kind of moral determination in the end. Obviously, the expert witnesses, except for those people that I mentioned at the very beginning of this talk, who are going after bits of paint and so on, all of these people are addressing themselves to the issue of moral knowledge. Everyone shall, until the contrary is proved, be presumed to be and to have been sane. I think, actually, no wiser statement than this has ever been proposed. Thank you very much.
Our speaker asked me to tell him 10 minutes before he should stop, and I would like to say that I had a note that said 9:15 and all's well, but I decided not to serve the summons. Dr. Malcolm Hess agreed to answer questions. I would remind you of the rules of the Institute, one brief question per person, and I would ask Dr. Malcolm to repeat the question for the benefit of the audience before he answers it. This is to test the state of mind both of the audience and of the speaker.
All right. Yes.
Dr. Malcolm, do you believe that Dr. Sass is correct
Well, now the question refers to a statement made by Dr. Sass, who has been a very prominent critic of psychiatry for a long year, many years, and that is that the man should be found guilty or not guilty in the course of the trial, and then be offered at that point the opportunity to either accept or decline treatment voluntarily himself. Now, I must tell you that, in my opinion, Dr. Sass has said a lot of things that I don't think are particularly helpful to anybody, but I think he has also said some extremely good things, too. And although I haven't myself reached any final conclusion on this question, I'm inclined to think that there is some merit in Sass's position there. I think that a person might be able to determine for himself whether he wants treatment. I think that's an important matter. Of course, I've often noticed, by the way, that it's probably irrelevant because clients, in my experience, invariably put themselves into the hands of their lawyer. And if their lawyer says, we, meaning you, are going for insanity, they do it. The client does not really reach that conclusion. The lawyer is... these clients or patients put themselves into the hands of the lawyer. So probably Sass is making an academic observation, if ever there was one. But if it was a real observation, I'd be inclined to agree with them. Is there an... Yes. Yes, this gentleman halfway up.
Would it help at all if the expert witnesses, I know it isn't black and white, I appreciate your gray distinction between, but generally speaking, would it help if those expert witnesses that deal with facts like a microscope people and so on, they should be dealing with the court, but the people like yourselves would be resources to the jury only.
Well, the question was that maybe all of these ballistics experts and toxicologists, the hard experts that I started with, would address the court, but the soft end of the spectrum people, like me, would only address the jury. Now, I fail to see the point of the question because what's the jury is the whole thing anyway. The ballistics people are going to speak to the jury, and so are these experts going to speak to the jury whenever they appear in the course of the trial. So I don't see what simplification there is according to this.
So, supplementary then, I thought speaking only to the jury when they reach their
well, as I understand it, everything that happens in the court has to be heard by the accused. I think that's very important. I can't see any... I don't see... You mean, what are you going to do? Exclude the accused man from the courtroom? And the judge and the... Yes. I may not understand the question, in which case, forgive me. Yes.
You would like to have the jury made a number of very important decisions, and I think the jury is able to do so. At the same time, the way the jury is treated by the court is... most humiliating way, like a bunch of numbskulls who can't be trusted with a little piece of information outside the court. They are locked up for weeks and months. They are not allowed to read newspapers or listen to the radio. Everything, like this typical incident in the Manson trial in California, where Charlie Manson waved a newspaper stating that Nixon had said Manson was guilty, and if the jury had seen that, they would all have mistrial.
All right. Now, I understand this question. I'll tell you how the question goes. It's suggested that in our courts of law at the present time, the jury is actually maltreated. It's treated as though it is made up of a bunch of numbskulls. The evidence for this is that the jury may even be sequestered on occasion, and they must be guarded against... learning certain pieces of information, for example, from newspapers and on the television. Well, frankly, I don't think that they're sequestered because they're numbskulls. I think they're sequestered because they're very bright and receptive and human. And indeed, the complaint is often made by the defense that they can be very badly prejudiced if they see a great big headline 4 inches high that gives information that the court has decided is not admissible evidence. And therefore, in some cases, I've observed the jury is sequestered, and it is very much in the interests of the accused. In my opinion, these courts are established in such a way as to ensure that justice is done. The courts that I've observed, and there have been quite a few of them, have treated the jury in the most gentle and decent way. The judges that I've watched have been extremely respectful of the jury and have gone out of their way to handle them in a comfortable way. Indeed, they've explained things in non-technical terms, but after all, lawyers speak in jargon. The jury have not been trained to understand the criminal code. Half the time, I think that lots of people don't understand some of the stuff that appears in the criminal code. It's so complicated. Professors of law, maybe, but it's pretty difficult. So I understand it if the judge makes an effort to put into ordinary English some point of law. That is not to be condescending toward the jury. That's only being realistic. Is there another question? Yes.
Have you ever had a lawyer as a patient?
The question is, have I ever had a lawyer as a patient? I can't remember. Is there a question here?
Yes. What was your argument for not having the soft experts appointed only by the court and therefore not allowing the defense or the crown to bring in their own soft experts?
Well, the question here is, if I proposed that maybe it would be a good idea to have the expert witnesses appointed by the court, that is to say by the judge, why did I suggest such a thing? Well, I did that initially because I really thought that this would protect them from adversarial combat. It's all based on this very civilized idea that there would be no corruption, that the court would be completely detached, as these judges tend to be, and they're disinterested in the whole thing, and therefore the psychiatrist would be retained. I suggested that the judge could either pick the psychiatrist or else the local academy of medicine would offer a bunch of names that could be picked from at random. And then in that way, they would never feel that they were the employees of either the Crown or the defense. Now, the more I thought about that, the more Justinian I saw it was, and I am aware that there have been a number of countries in which the adversarial system has not prevailed, and they have been among the most corrupt countries in the whole world and the most dangerous to live in through long periods of their history, and therefore the conclusion is that that is not any good protection for us. We better subject these expert witnesses to the misery of being expert witnesses and hired by the parties. And further, I then found that many American states do permit that. They permit the judge to appoint lawyers, but in those cases, it has happened that the parties are permitted to appoint their own psychiatrists, you see, in which case all you get is an even greater confusion. So it just didn't seem to help, so I gave up that idea.
We have time for one more question. There's one at the back.
Way at the back. The question, which I may have missed a few words of it, was, is there any attempt within the courtroom to try to bring about some harmony between the very disharmonious opinions presented by these adversarial psychiatrists? And the answer is that in some cases I've seen judges attempt to do that, but in most cases I've seen that they have not attempted to do that. They've left it up to the jury to decide. They've left it up to the parties, the adversarial lawyers, to make it clear enough in the course of their examination and cross-examination and re-examination that a given psychiatrist is just absolutely full of nonsense. And the lawyers can do this reasonably well. And if a psychiatrist does have some intelligence and some learning, it kind of shows. And I have not really seen an effort for the judge to step in and say, well, look, we've had this piece of statement here, and on the other hand this, but in fact the real answer is this. The judge is not actually equipped to do that. How can the judge oppose the position of these two guys who spent 25 years of their lives studying psychiatry? I mean, that isn't his business, and so he can't really presume to do that. He is there to deal with problems around the law. So the answer is no, I haven't seen much of an attempt to bring them all together that way. But nevertheless, the jury has a tendency to make up its mind, and it's just astonishing how often the mind that they finally make up seems to me to be pretty close to good justice. Okay.
I'd like to call on Dr. Anthony Marcus, who's head of the Division of Forensic Psychiatry at the Psychiatry Department of UBC, to thank our speaker.
Mr. Vice President, Dr. Malcolm, when we look at each other's profession across what I think is a rather wide watershed, I have the feeling that the law may see psychiatry as the relentless pursuit of the id by the odd, and that it may see psychiatry perhaps as a profession where we're involved in teaching people to stand on their own two feet while they lie down perpetually on a couch. We, from our side, often see the law straining within its convoluted technicalities, perhaps in much the way that the Lord Chief Justice of England recently said of his own role. He said, "I spend the greater part of my judicial time investigating collisions between motorized vehicles, each on its own side of the road, each sounding its horn, and each stationary." Andrew Malcolm is a man concerned with what is truly meant by personal responsibility. He's concerned about the texture of that responsibility within a fabric of law that serves to affirm and protect the sacrosanct and unique rights of the individual. He believes that both our professions are engaged in seeking for what Disraeli in the House of Commons said a long time ago, that justice is truth in action. I would say if freedom is the singing bird, then the law is what ensures that it's there in the sky. Andrew Malcolm's paper tonight has cogently and forthrightly shown us some of the dilemmas of our ongoing confrontation. On your behalf and on behalf of the Vancouver Institute, I sincerely like it to thank him for his effort.
I would remind you of two things in parting. we delight in our members, and if you wish to do the decent thing, the table is just outside. We delight in our speakers. Next week, Dr. Randall Ivany, the Ombudsman for the province of Alberta, will be here. His topic is, Whither Goes the Ombudsman? Thank you.